From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Jay Clayton.
And I'm Rachel Young.
This week on War News Radio, Tremors.
First, we learn more about the growing conflict in South Sudan.
Next, we present our editorial segment, Filibusted.
Then, we take a look at the media's speculation about the possibility of a terrorist attack at the Olympic Games.
Finally, we hear from two prominent figures about the roots of genocide in the modern era.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
Syria missed the deadline for handing over its chemical weapons stockpile to the United Nations earlier this week. Although Syria alleged that safety concerns caused delays, United States officials dismissed this claim. A State Department spokesman stated, quote, "The regime has every tool they need in order to deliver on their promise of moving the chemical weapons. So far, only 4% of Syria's dangerous chemicals have been sent to be destroyed." Syria also missed last year's December 31st deadline to remove chemicals, turning them over only late into January. Syria signed a disarmament agreement with the United States last year and agreed to eliminate its entire chemical weapons stockpile under a timetable set up by the United Nations Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, or OPCW. Despite OPCW's concerns about the delay, Russian officials have announced plans to cooperate with Syria to remove most chemical substances by the end of February.
Deadly bombings occurred across Iraq this week, killing 33 people and injuring at least 123 others. According to Baghdad police officials, multiple bombers targeted checkpoints for entry into the international zone, a heavily fortified area containing the Iraqi government offices and the United States and British embassies. Two car bombs also exploded near a populated commercial area in southeastern Baghdad, and two bombs detonated at a coffee shop and restaurant in Al-Daraa. Several car bombings also occurred across the northern Iraqi town of Mosul. The United Nations Special Representative in Iraq, Nikolai Mladenov, spoke out against the violence, stating, quote, "Those who orchestrate such attacks should be condemned by all political, religious, and civic leaders in this country. Iraq's political leaders should show national unity in dealing with such threats and unite against terrorism."
North and South Korean delegates Park Young-il and Lee Duk-heng met on the North Korean side of the border village Panmunjom this week to discuss reuniting family members that have been separated since the Korean War. The delegates agreed to host reunions later this month for 100 randomly selected residents of both countries. Demand for the reunions is high. 73,000 South Koreans are currently on the Red Cross's waiting list for participating in the family reunions, and half of them are over 80 years old. Family reunions between North and South Korea have typically been initiated during periods of détente, though relations remain fraught between the two countries. Annual South Korean military drills near the border have been frequently criticized by the North Korean government. Some fear that the continuation of these training drills might jeopardize next month's reunion.
Uniformed soldiers publicly lynched a man at a military ceremony in the Central African Republic earlier this week. The attack occurred after a speech by interim president Catherine Samba Panza expressing hope that the armed forces would return peace to the war-torn country. Samba Panza's calls for unity, however, seemingly fell on deaf ears. Mere minutes after Samba Panza's departure, 20 soldiers ambushed and killed a man they believed to be a member of the Salika rebel group. This recent incident was not the first of its type in the country. Peter Buchart, a representative from the Human Rights Watch, observed that attempted lynchings have become common responses to widespread sectarian violence. Buchart further underscored the relationship between the lynching and the country's future. In a statement, he noted that the ceremony was, quote, "a moment of hope that suddenly turned into a moment of absolute horror. It's not calming down. The horror is still unfolding."
The New York Times revealed this week that Afghan President Hamid Karzai's government has been engaging in secret talks with Taliban insurgents. Following the story's release, a member of Afghanistan's High Peace Council confirmed that, quote, "talks took place in Dubai 3 weeks ago between government officials and Taliban who flew from Doha, but we are still waiting to see the result." The United States State Department has voiced support for the talks. A spokesperson for the department released a statement saying, quote, "We have strongly supported an Afghan-led reconciliation, which would, of course, be Afghans talking to Afghans."
Zamaldin Mirzayev, the suspect allegedly responsible for the twin Volgograd bombings in December, was reported dead at his home earlier this week. News reports suggest that Mirzayev and an accomplice were shot by Russian security forces at a standoff at his house, located in the Dagestan Republic in Russia's North Caucasus region. A third man surrendered to police in the Russian town of Izbirbosh, and two others have been arrested in relation to the attacks. The bombings killed 34 people and wounded 60 others, raising concerns about the risks of terrorism in the weeks preceding the Winter Olympics in Sochi.
This is War News Radio. The world's newest country, South Sudan, has recently been in the news for a rebellion that began on December 15, 2013, between President Salva Kiir Mayardit and supporters of former Vice President Riek Machar. What are the origins of this violence? Who are the parties involved? And how did South Sudan come to be? War News Radio's Dylan Okabe-Jaudat explores the answers to these questions and more.
Sounds of jubilation from this year's South Sudanese Independence Day in the moments before four-year President Salva Kiir Mayardit delivers a speech to a crowd. South Sudan has come a long way since January 1956, when the Republic of Sudan was established, formally granting the country independence from British rule. South Sudan began its struggle for increased representation and regional autonomy from Sudan in 1955, with the first Sudanese civil war between the South Sudanese Anyanya Rebel Army and the government of Sudan. During Sudan's independence process, South Sudanese leaders accused new Sudanese authorities of backing out of promises to establish a federal system and of imposing Islamic or Arab identity on the country. In 1971, the former army lieutenant Joseph Lagu assembled all of the guerrilla bands under his South Sudan Liberation Movement, the first organization capable of negotiating on behalf of the entire South. In 1972, mediation resulted in the formation of the Addis Ababa Agreement, which established the Southern Sudan Autonomous Region and provided peace for 11 years. Civil unrest, however, struck the region again in 1983. The president of Sudan, Ghaffar Numeri, declared all of Sudan an Islamic state under Sharia law and abolished the Southern Sudan Autonomous Region, ending the Addis Ababa Agreement. In response, the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, known as SPLM, was formed and developed a military force known as the Sudanese People's Liberation Army. The army rebelled against the Sudanese government, leading to the Second Sudanese Civil War. The conflict lasted for 22 years, the longest civil war in Africa. In 2005, the Comprehensive Peace Agreement was signed and lasted until 2011, when South Sudan finally gained independence in July. According to the British Broadcasting Corporation, 99% of South Sudanese voted in favor of a split from Sudan in a referendum of independence launched by the peace agreement. Did autonomy bring an end to conflict in the region? Disputes over oil have continued. The 2005 peace agreement stipulated that 50% of oil revenues go to both South Sudan and Sudan, although this portion of the deal was supposed to expire with South Sudan's independence. South Sudan stopped exporting oil to Sudan in January of 2011, but resumed trade in March of 2013. The revenue from oil now comprises a significant portion of South Sudan's gross domestic product, which was previously dominated by agriculture. On December 15, 2013, conflict broke out in South Sudan when a faction of the Sudan People's Liberation Army allegedly attempted a coup in South Sudan against President Salva Kiir Mayardit. He announced that the attempted coup was suppressed and blamed former Vice President Riek Machar for the alleged coup. Machar denied any knowledge of the faction's plans and blamed Kiir for engaging in power politics. The fighting erupted on December 16th and extended beyond the capital of Juba to areas vulnerable to political instability. The current situation in South Sudan is an ongoing humanitarian crisis. According to Gerard Araud, French ambassador to the UN,
The members of the Security Council stressed the necessity for all parties to reject this violence in all its forms and to resolve disagreements peacefully, and called on President Salva Kiir and former Vice President Riek Machar to demonstrate leadership in bringing a swift and peaceful resolution to this crisis by calling for a cessation of hostilities and immediately commencing a dialogue.
As many as 1 million people have been displaced in the recent fighting in South Sudan, and thousands of people have been killed. As of February 4, 2014, more than 80,000 South Sudanese refugees are currently protected by the UN mission in South Sudan at 8 of its compounds throughout the country, with 43,000 refugees just at its base in Juba. At UN mission hospitals in Juba, the number of casualties continue to grow, with an average of 10 to 15 admittances per day. Where is the humanitarian crisis going, and how is the UN intervening? According to UN officials, 4,700 tons of World Food Program aid from warehouses across the country were looted by both sides and civilians. Hospitals are already overcrowded, and conditions of refugee camps run by the UN mission in South Sudan are predicted to worsen. In the coming months, the arrival of rain may heighten cases of malaria and cholera, making life for refugees even more volatile. On February 4, 2014, the UN Humanitarian Coordinator for South Sudan, Toby Lanzer, addressed the sustainability of providing aid.
We now aim to assist 3.2 million people, and for us to operate between now and June, we require $1.27 billion.
The South Sudanese government signed a peace agreement with a rebel group in Jonglei State, where South Sudan agreed to a ceasefire with rebels who took up arms after the alleged coup in December of 2013. However, clashes have continued despite the signing of the deal. According to UN Deputy High Commissioner for Refugees, Alexander Alenikov, quote, "Ultimately, the solution here is for negotiations to go forward. There was the cessation of the hostilities signed in Addis Ababa. That process needs to go forward. The confidence-building steps need to be taken so people feel safe to return to their homes. There needs to be a political process that will ultimately solve the problems of internal displacement." Mr. Alenikov is not alone in his support for negotiations between the South Sudanese government and opposition leaders. And while many have labeled the current conflict an ethnic dispute, there is little evidence that the disagreements are anything other than territorial and ideological.
Sabrina Merrill contributed research and helped with the editing for this piece.
This is War News Radio. Sometimes it's hard to read the news without getting angry. Caroline Batten and Tyler Welsh have stopped trying. War News Radio proudly presents Filibusted, an editorial segment dedicated to news that makes us tear our hair out.
Against all odds, we have the Winter Olympics to look forward to.
Unless the Russians can't finish carting in all the snow that balmy 60 degrees and sunny Sochi doesn't have.
And Russian President Vladimir Putin is doing everything he can to make it a fun, welcoming games for all.
Dare we say, a gay old time?
Yep, that's right. Vladimir Putin, a shining beacon of tolerance and acceptance.
Putin took offense at the suggestion that his law prohibiting the publication of, quote, propaganda of non-traditional sexual relations discriminates against gay citizens.
Despite the fact that anti-gay violence has risen to epic proportions in Russia, with conservative vigilante groups seizing and humiliating gay teenagers on camera.
In fact, Putin thinks his country's policies toward the gay Olympic athletes arriving in Sochi are more than fair.
At a press conference, Putin even said, quote, "We're not rounding people up. They will not be harassed. Just please, stay away from the children."
Wow! No one's getting rounded up and sent to a gulag based on their sexual preferences. Vladimir, you have outdone yourself. What more could we possibly ask for?
Maybe, you know, fewer accusations of pedophilia?
Well, it's really only the gay foreigners that Putin has to worry about, because according to the mayor of Sochi, Russia doesn't have any gay people.
Anatoly Pakhomov told the BBC that there aren't any gay people in his city. When pressed, he admitted that he wasn't sure about that because he, quote, "doesn't bloody know them."
Remember that time former Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said there were no homosexuals in Iran? This is like that, only stupider. Because according to Reuters, there are at least two gay clubs in Sochi and multiple openly LGBT communities in the area.
But homophobic ignorance isn't the only issue on Putin's plate as the Olympics approach.
Despite the February 7 start date and the $51 billion spent, there are still a few minor projects to finish up.
Like building three of the nine media hotels, for example.
According to the sports analysts arriving in Sochi, the living conditions are, to put it nicely, unusual. One reporter was simply told, quote, "You will not get a shower curtain." But that's nothing compared to the rooms that lack heat and clean water, or finished floors.
But floorless hotels and poisonous faucets aren't the only things one has to worry about in Russia.
Especially if, say, you run a satirical Twitter account making fun of the Russian government, and your identity gets leaked.
Whatever retaliation political satirists Katya Romanovskaya and Arseny Bobrovsky were expecting, though, it definitely wasn't this.
Romanovskaya emerged from her apartment to discover that someone had chained a massive, 200-pound, elaborately carved wooden phallus to the hood of Bobrovsky's car.
Lovingly handcrafted with lifelike veins.
You mess with the government messes back with a huge wooden penis.
Actually, though, journalists have been speculating that this is the work of Nashi, a pro-Kremlin youth group funded by the state. They have a distinctly juvenile sense of humor and like to do things like lure opposition leaders into bug departments using prostitutes.
So the Kremlin has groups of hormonally crazed teenagers running around stalking comedians, discovering the locations of their homes and cars, and using all that power to make the world's most irritating Sputnik joke.
And Putin's concerned that gay people are corrupting Russian children.
To top it all off, it turns out Russia and the good old US of A are back to their old habits. That is, hating each other's guts.
Duh. The White House has claimed that Russia bugged, and then leaked, a phone conversation between two American diplomats in Kiev.
Apparently, they were discussing the current protests in Ukraine when one of them bluntly said, "the EU" into the phone.
Continuing the bold legacy of US foreign policy.
Though, of course, it remains the job of poor, beleaguered Press Secretary Jay Carney to assure us that U.S. relations with the EU are stronger than ever.
While we're on the subject, it turns out that the U.S. and Russia aren't the only ones experiencing diplomatic struggles at the moment.
Apparently, Al-Qaeda has officially cut all ties with its Syrian affiliate group, the Islamic State of Iraq, also known as ISIS. Why? Because, wait for it, they're too extreme.
Wait, we are talking about the same Al-Qaeda, right? The notorious terrorist organization behind the attacks of September 11th, multiple embassy bombings, massacres of other Muslims, and countless suicide attacks? The ones who think the killing of civilians is religiously justified.
How horrible do you have to be to freak out Ayman al-Zawahiri, former right-hand man to Osama bin Laden? This is the man who called on Al-Qaeda militants to kidnap as many tourists as possible in 2012. And ISIS is too extreme for him?
If the Islamic State of Iraq is looking for an appropriate form of revenge, maybe they should take a page out of Nashi's book.
Ew.
A big thanks to writer Jay Clayton for his unusual quips. For Filibusted, I'm Tyler Welsh.
And I'm Caroline Batten. As always, it's been a pleasure. At least for us.
This is War News Radio. As the world's premier sporting event, the Olympic Games have inspired global excitement and optimism every 2 years for many decades. Now, all eyes are on Russia as the 2014 Winter Games are set to begin in Sochi. In recent months, an influx of terror attacks in the tumultuous North Caucasus region near Sochi has stirred public skepticism about Russia's ability to prevent and respond to potential catastrophe. War News Radio's Will Sullivan took a look at the public's concerns and predictions leading up to the start of the Games.
Sochi is a small resort city on the coast of the Black Sea, near the border between Russia and Georgia. Unlike most of the country, it benefits from a mild winter climate, yet still has access to ski slopes just a few miles inland, making it a seemingly perfect site for the Winter Games. Sochi is located near the North Caucasus region, which has been home to, quote, the most active insurgency crisis in Europe, according to Ekaterina Sokryanskaya, project director for the International Crisis Group in the area. In the 1990s, the Russian government thwarted a separatist movement in the North Caucasus's Chechen Republic, and the region has been plagued by violence from radical insurgents ever since. Last month, the global media went into a frenzy after two consecutive terror attacks occurred in the city of Volgograd, located 400 miles north of Sochi. On December 29th, 17 people were killed in a suicide bombing at the city's central train station. Just one day later, another 14 were killed, and tens more injured, in a bombing on a trolley bus during the morning rush hour. The attacks arrive in the wake of last summer's call by Doku Umarov, the leader of a Chechen extremist group, for his followers to disrupt the games with violence.
The two attacks, first yesterday and then again this morning, sent an unmistakable and chilling message that Islamic terrorists in Russia intend to do all they can to disrupt the Winter Games, only 400 miles and 6 weeks away.
Will the games be safe? This is the question that has been posed over and over by international media sources for several weeks now as the Olympics draw nearer.
Just straight up, the question is that these Olympics are going to take place full speed ahead in Sochi, which essentially is right next door to a war zone. Was it a mistake to choose that spot?
Large-scale events like the Olympics often instill public fear about potential terrorist threats, but news sources around the globe have taken on an unusually cynical stance leading up to this year's games. For the first time in history, the Olympics are being held at the edge of a war zone, said the New York Times in an article on Wednesday. A Washington Post article published in late December called Putin's decision to host the games in Sochi both a, quote, daring bid and a, quote, gutsy gamble. Russian authorities have been forward about the surveillance operations underway and the safety precautions in place.
Security zones will start operating. There'll be a controlled zone near Olympic venues. You can get into those if you have a ticket for an event and proof of identity. And there'll be the so-called forbidden zone outside Sochi, large areas outside Sochi too. Now, add to all of that, tens of thousands of police and interior ministry troops, warships in the Black Sea, and anti-aircraft missiles. And you can see why Russian officials are calling this the most secure games ever.
Despite the extensive measures, media sources are skeptical that the Russians will meet the security standards set by the Summer Olympic Games of 2012 in London. ABC News said that there was, quote, little cause for optimism that the Russian government would be able to do so.
Questions about security continue to hound these games. U.S. officials tell ABC News that they ran a simulation a few months ago that found major problems with Russia's emergency response plan. They say that they think the Russians are so focused on trying to stop a terror attack, they haven't thought enough about how to respond to one.
And yet, Russian authorities have continued to show confidence in their protective measures in the face of pessimism. In an interview on CNN, Russian ambassador Sergei Kislyak defended Russian strategies in defending against an attack.
We do not take it lightly. So we have a good planning. We have excellent specialists who are working on it. We have put a pretty strong team that is working to deny terrorists any chance of success. And I'm absolutely sure that we are going to succeed.
But United States Representative Mike Rogers of Michigan is not certain that Russia can stop the terrorists, stating his desires for the Russians to share more intelligence information with the United States.
Well, I have real concerns about the safety. You know, the Russians have not been fully cooperative on a security front with sharing information that might be helpful in the securing of both of our athletes and the participants, people who are there to view the games.
Rogers later retracted his claim about Russia's cooperation, but continued to insist that Russia's behavior was unprofessional.
They're cooperating to a small degree, but there is information that we think is valuable about organizational activities that we're fairly confident that the Russians track, that they're just not sharing with our security forces.
But what Ambassador Kislyak has to say about cooperation does not match up.
What I hear from specialists, not people who are judging from outside, they're pretty comfortable with the level of cooperation that they are getting from Russian law enforcement.
Not all American politicians share the concerns of the media and Mike Rogers about the security at the Games. President Barack Obama displayed confidence in Russia's ability to orchestrate a safe event in a January interview on CNN.
I believe that Sochi is safe and that there are always some risks in these large international gatherings. I'm always going to feel even better if it's inside the United States, because then we have full control over what happens. But the Russian authorities understand the stakes here. They understand that there are potential threats that are out there, and we are coordinating with them. We've looked at their plans. I think we have a good sense of the security that they're putting in place to protect not only the athletes themselves, but also visitors there. So what I would say is that if you want to go to the Olympics, you should go to the Olympics.
Is the widespread pessimism grounded in reality, or are news sources responding to the longstanding tensions between the United States and Russia? It is impossible to say until the Sochi Games have been completed. But the American media seems more willing to trust American officials than they do the Russians. And it is clear that the global news media is expecting the worst, even as we hope for the best.
This is War News Radio. On September 29, 2013, the Jewish Values Network hosted a UN Week discussion on genocide. Moderated by Rabbi Shmuley Boteach, who calls himself America's Rabbi, the forum featured Nobel Prize laureate and Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel and the controversial president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame. War News Radio's Patrick Hahn reports.
This is a historic evening. It has long been my desire, as someone who believes that combating genocide is the foremost humanitarian obligation of our time, is that ensuring that the words never again mean just that, never again, that no child will ever die because of race or creed, that no man or woman will ever die because of religion or race, that human life should be of infinite value, and that we are sick and tired of a world that turns a blind eye to the mass slaughter of innocents because of the color of their skin or because of their religious identity or because of their spiritual beliefs, that this must finally stop.
That's Rabbi Shmuley Boteach, or America's Rabbi, at a UN Week discussion on genocide at Cooper Union, New York City, on September 29, 2013. A regular on TV, radio, and print media around the world, the Washington Post and Newsweek call Shmuley the most famous rabbi in America, and for good reason. Shmuley is founder of This World, the Values Network, a global media organization, quote, dedicated to advancing universal Jewish values in the media and culture, and to affirming the Jewish people as a light unto the nations. Shmuley regularly hosts debates between world leaders on the leading issues of our time. The topic of this particular evening's discussion?
Do the strong nations of this world have a responsibility to expend treasure and even blood to protect the weak?
This question was especially relevant in the wake of the recent chemical slaughter in Syria and the 20th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide. On this momentous night, he invited a dear friend and mentor to speak on the timely topic, an eyewitness to the horrors of genocide.
The prince of the Jewish people, one, the great light of our nation to the rest of the world, the world's foremost Jewish personality, on anyone's list, Elie Wiesel would be on a list of the three most respected men alive. Ladies and gentlemen, the very conscience and representative of the martyred 6 million of the Holocaust, Nobel Peace Laureate Elie Wiesel.
Nobel Prize Laureate and Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel, on the eve of his 85th birthday, reminded us of the perils of indifference in the face of evil, especially in the face of genocide.
One of the most beautiful sentences in the world, naturally, thou shalt not stand idly by. What are we doing as teachers, as writers, as humanists? Simply by not standing idly by. When we study our contemporary history books, what hurts It's not so much, of course, that hurts more than anything in the world, the elements of the tragedy, but the indifference of the world.
Wiesel points out how nothing is more painful to a victim of atrocity than knowing that he is alone and no one cares.
There is one sin that I refuse, is to allow another person who suffers to think that nobody cares. That's the worst that can happen. That person is suffering or being persecuted or being tormented and tortured, and nobody cares.
In one particularly poignant line, Wiesel argues that we can be indifferent to our own suffering, but not the suffering of another.
I can say I suffer, it's my right. But I cannot accept the suffering of another person.
Shmuley also hosted another guest, also a champion of his people, during a low-tech genocide, when the world turned its back on his people.
And then a man who, as you just heard, can claim to be the only person alive to have stopped the genocide. Mr. President, I so revere and honor those who are champions of their people. And when in 1994, between April and June, when you saw your people being slaughtered in the fastest genocide in the history of the world, with 330 being hacked to death per hour in a low-tech genocide, when you saw the world turn its back on your people, you decided that they would have only one champion, and that would be you and your army, who would put an end to the genocide. You did so, and as such, you became a hero to all of us who believe that combating genocide is our foremost obligation, ladies and gentlemen, the President of Rwanda, Paul Kagame.
Shmuley was quick to flatter President Kagame with accolades, but not everyone was so quick to sing Kagame's praises.
Excuse me, please. You know, here we are trying to talk about genocide and the slaughter of innocents, and how dare you interrupt it when so many innocent people have died in the 20th century. Can someone please tell this heckler that they should not disrupt the world, the face of the Holocaust to the world?
The protester, or heckler as Shmuley called him, accused General Kagame of war crimes during the Rwandan Civil War in 1994, pointing to widespread allegations of supporting retribution killings following the genocide, as well as reports of political repression in his country. Human rights groups have also accused Kagame of sponsoring two controversial rebel wars in Zaire and two insurgencies in the Democratic Republic of Congo, among other accusations. Kagame's past and present policies, which often employ political violence and military force, continue to shroud him in controversy. And this evening was no exception, as the heckling quickly devolved into a shouting match with a rabbi, until Kagame's private security officers removed him from the premises.
Can someone please... Now, this is astonishing. We have Elie Wiesel speaking, whose birthday is tomorrow, his 85th birthday, thank God, and this man has absolutely no respect. How dare you?
Clearly, President Kagame is not the blameless savior of Rwanda that Shmuley made him out to be. Unfazed, Kagame delivered his talking points with the feel-good rhetoric of an experienced politician performing PR damage control. He spent much of his time emphasizing that genocide does not erupt in a vacuum, pointing to the injustices of colonial history and the legacy of racial prejudice.
From outside, when there was this kind of response of indifference, of saying, well, this is how it plays out in Africa with Africans. It's just one, some would call them tribes, others ethnic groups. And it's like, well, we can have one kill the other, and it usually happens, and it would play out, and we would move on.
Yet when asked if he would blame the United States and the international community for how the Rwandan genocide played out, Kagame tried to take the moral high ground.
One lesson we learned along the way was not to dwell so much on blaming others for what has happened or what has not happened.
Rabbi Shmuley pointed out that Kagame had to, in one sense, give up on the world and to protect his people at all costs.
Is one of the reasons Rwanda is controversial is that you maintain that attitude? You can all criticize me. I'm going to protect my people. I don't care what you say. You can hate me. You can heckle me. But I've learned already I can't rely on you. So to hell with your criticisms. I'm the president of Rwanda. My people experience a genocide. I have to protect them.
Kagame concurred, skillfully portraying himself as a selfless pragmatist who took any means necessary to bring peace, order, and security to his war-torn country. According to him, it's easy to criticize after the fact when nothing is at stake, but circumstances were different at the time. After all, hindsight is 20/20.
Because if we had wasted time thinking about others, what they are able to do for us or what they are not able to do for us.
Kagame even claims that he was not only able to put an end to the massacre in his own country, but is also working to protect other nations from genocide.
There is a very central element to do with that. In what we do, there's no doubt about it. And that lesson has come to stay with us because we see it every day from that time of 1994 up to this moment. We see it. We see it happen to us. We see it happen in other places. So, again, this is why I'm saying we try to do the best we can for ourselves. And in fact, even within our limited means, we try to do what we can for others in the same situation. We have been able to participate in peace support operations across the world, whether it is in Sudan or South Sudan or Haiti, or stems from that kind of understanding of can we do something even for others, but certainly we concentrate on trying to make sure that our own situation is quite in order.
It seemed as if Kagame gave all the right answers and delivered all the right sound bites, but like Wiesel, was unable to say very much in the way of concrete, real-world solutions in Syria and Iran, or to offer a prescription to prevent such egregious atrocities from happening again. Perhaps the answer to that question is the same answer Wiesel gave to another question, whether we should hate evil and evil people.
Hate is too easy almost. What do you do with it? Okay, you hate, and then what? Once you hate, then it's, the chapter is closed. That chapter is not closed.
Wiesel does not pretend to have all the answers, and he does not shy away from acknowledging this.
Once you say hatred is not the answer, then you ask, well, what is the answer? And there, I say, okay, then now let's go and study.
Maybe there are no easy answers to the question of genocide, though neither Kagame nor Wiesel gave us a recipe for preventing and stopping such crimes against humanity in the future. They seem to be taking Wiesel's advice to heart by doing the hard work of studying the genocides they witnessed firsthand, by sharing their eyewitness testimonies and insights, which were gained at a great cost, with a world weary from the trauma of genocide. They are doing just that.
As you know, I love questions more than answers.
Though radically different men with different beliefs, both Wiesel and Kagame have demonstrated that blaming and hating others are an end rather than a beginning. Now they call on us to take responsibility for our mistakes instead of pointing fingers, and to raise our voices in creative anger rather than embracing hate, or worst of all, embracing indifference. For War News Radio, I'm Patrick Hahn.
Jerry Quinn contributed research for this piece.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Anissa Andrabi, Amy DiPiero, Joel Hajboutros, Colin Smith, Tyler Welsh, Chloe Wittenberg, and Henry Zhang. Our piece editors are Sabrina Merrill, Sadie Rittman, Chloe Wittenberg, and Henry Zhang. I'm Jay Clayton.
And I'm Rachel Young. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Nora Balin contributed research and helped with the editing for this piece.